So I think I pretty much got through six entirely, didn't I? I told you about energy density. Did I mention that?
I don't remember.
I thought we were on slide five.
Oh, well, then the answer is clearly no.
We
did.
We're on slide four. Yeah.
Four?
You? Or five.
Yeah, okay, five. Okay. Oh, I think I got through two of these groupings, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So we talked about whether how long the carbon skeleton is. That's one way of classifying alkanes, hydrocarbons. Doesn't have to be alkanes. And branching, whether or not it's branched. But we can also classify them based on presence or absence of double bonds. Of course, alkanes, by definition, don't have any double bonds, right? But alkenes do, and we're looking at two alkenes here, two versions of butene, and that's why there's one and two in the names. One denotes that the double bond is between the first and second carbon, the other one between the second and third carbon. And that doesn't seem like much of a difference, but that makes them separate chemicals with at least slightly different properties. And then the fourth classification is based on whether or not the organic compound or hydrocarbon has any rings in it. Cyclohexane, benzene are ringed structures, and they're just a couple of many. These little diagrams next to them, though, are alternative ways of conveying the structure of the molecule. This is extreme shorthand devised by people that were sick and tired of writing C's and H's over and over on blackboards before there were computers. This really means exactly the same thing. You could do this with any organic compound, actually. Ethane, here up in the upper left-hand corner, would simply be a dash. And propane would be like a caret symbol. Whenever you have a tip or a bend, and it's not labeled with some letter with a letter at all, then you just assume it's a carbon. So this means there's two carbons, this means there's three, and notice that there's one on every corner of this hexagon. And then after you mentally fill in the carbons, then you have to mentally fill in however many hydrogens are necessary to bring the valence correct. So you know that since this is a carbon connected to another carbon, it's making only one bond, so you need three hydrogens here and three hydrogens here, just mentally. Okay, so it's extreme shorthand, really. Okay, let's go on to the next slide that I thought we were already on. Slide six. We're looking at a fat molecule here, and we'll have a lot more to say about fat in the next chapter after this upcoming test. But I just want to talk a little bit about it now. A fat molecule is something that you can assemble out of smaller parts. And this, notice that there's one end of it here where all these other yellow background items are connected. That's a glycerol. By itself, it would be a glycerol molecule. But if you make bonds to connect these three fatty acid tails, then the overall thing is a fat. And fats are important for various reasons, including that they are excellent ways to store energy. Just like hydrocarbons are, I think I already told you that hydrocarbons in general make excellent fuels, right? Like gasoline, which is a mixture of hydrocarbons. That's true if you burn hydrocarbons, you put a match to gasoline, it's going to give you a lot of energy output right away. Or you burn it in the engine little by little. But it's also true within cells. Now, a fat is not a hydrocarbon because it has more than carbon and hydrogen in it. There are some oxygen molecules in here, oxygen atoms in here as well. And even if you dismantled this thing and took the fatty acids off Each fatty acid technically isn't a hydrocarbon either, because there's an oxygen at the end of it. But other than that oxygen atom, the whole length of the tail otherwise is nothing but carbons and hydrogens. So fatty acids are chock full of energy, just like a hydrocarbon is. When you have carbon-hydrogen bonds, there's a lot of energy that you can extract from that if you break that bond, which you do in combustion reactions, whether you're burning it, a hydrocarbon in an internal combustion engine, or whether you are using cellular respiration in the cells to extract the energy from a fat from a fatty acid that came from a fat, or actually other fuels as well. Okay, so much more about that in Unit 3, but I just wanted to introduce fats. Now we can go to 7, and I think I told you the word isomer last time, right? And isomers are chemicals that are distinct from each other. They have their own properties, but they have exactly the same chemical formulae, which in turn means they are made up of exactly the same kind and number of atoms, just with a different arrangement somehow. And in organic chemistry, there is just a hell of a lot of isomers. So isomers is a big group by itself, a big set, and there are different categories of isomers, and more than just these three, but these are the three that are important in this course. On the top, we have structural isomers, and this is, I think, an example that I showed you when I first told you the word isomers. Structural isomers are isomers by virtue of there just being a different arrangement of the carbon skeleton. So you have a linear version of a 5-carbon compound here, pentane, and a branched version, 2-methylbutane. But each of them has exactly 5 carbons and exactly 12 hydrogens. So they're both C5H12. And that's why, in the case of isomers, the chemical formula doesn't really pin it down. It's ambiguous. The name is not, on the other hand. All right, well, in B, we have another category of isomers, which is geometric isomers. Here's where it helps that you already have played around with the balls and sticks. If you think back to building your models, the single bonds were represented by just a stick, right? And it's easy to swivel atoms that are formed by a single bond. You can spin it, right? But you can't do that with a double bond. You can for a little bit, but not indefinitely, right? And therefore, there are two possibilities when you involve a double bond. You can have these things denoted by X, which doesn't really refer to anything specifically. X is not a chemical symbol. It just means anything, really. You could have them both on one side, both on the same side of the double bond, or you could have them on opposite sides of the double bond. Now, notice that if this were a single bond, these would be exactly the same chemical, right? Because you could just spin it to make the other. They aren't really distinct. But since you can't spin a double bond, it's either one or the other, and it doesn't seem like much of a difference, but that makes them act chemically different, at least a little. And so there are two versions of any given geometric isomer pair, the so-called cis isomer and trans isomer. Cis and trans are opposites. Cis means on the same side. Trans means across or opposite side. It's we use the roots in other words as well, like cisgender and transgender, for instance, or cisgene and transgene in biology we use, depending, doesn't matter what the meanings are, it's just that these recur. Cis and trans are used a lot. Cis, though, means same side. Trans is a cross. That leads to the final category that we care about in here of isomers, which are the enantiomers. And enantiomers are examples of molecules that we say are chiral, which literally means handed, which is why you have hands here in the figure. It's the same root as in chiropractor, for instance, which someone that works on you with hands. Handedness is a good analogy for molecules, even though they don't really have hands. Handedness means that there is a left-handed version and a right-handed version. And so, don't worry about the molecules for a second. If you consider your hands, they're very similar, but they're not the same, right? If you cut them off so you could just work with them in space, there's no way that you could flip over or turn your right hand in any way and make it into your left hand, right? They're always going to be different from each other because they're mirror images. Similar, but not the same. Well, you can have mirror images of molecules as well, and it happens often in organic compounds because of the tetravalence of carbon. Tetravalence of carbon means carbon's always going to be forming four bonds, right? Sometimes that means four single bonds, which means carbon's in the center of a tetrahedron, and those four things that it's connected to are on the points of the tetrahedron. Well, if that happens and all four of those things carbon is connected to are different from each other, then if you imagine making the, as they are here in this example, if you imagine making that ball and stick model, there is no way, after you have it constructed, that you can pick it up, turn it around, or whatever, and make it into the other one, the mirror image one. You would have to break two bonds and swap them to make the other version. So they're distinct mirror image molecules, and by analogy with our hands, we say they're chiral, and we give them designations, which there's different standards for the designations, but L and D are used. L stands for levo, which means left, and D stands for dextro, which means right. This is where we're kind of unfair to the left-handed people of the world, since they're the minority. Like the word dextrous literally means right-handed. If someone is dextrous, it literally means right-handed. But what we mean is that that person works well with his or her hands, as though left-handed people can't. And ambidextrous literally means having two right hands, which no one does, of course. But instead of it meaning having left and right hand equally good use, it means that person is acting like he has two right hands. Anyway, that's just one designation, L and D. It's not used for every chiral compound. In fact, in slide 8, we see another designation. These are also chiral compounds, but S and R are used. R stands for recto, which means right or straight. And S stands for sinistro. It's another bad thing about how we treat left-handers. The word sinister literally means left-handed, but we use it to mean that person is suspicious because he or she is left-handed. So the point of this slide, though, is that, well, here we have drugs. These are exogenous signal molecules, as we've talked about before, right? And what did I say has to be true if any given signal molecule, whether it's exogenous or endogenous, is going to have any effect? What has to happen?
No signal prior to have an effect without nicotine receptor.
That's right. In order for anything to happen in response to a signal molecule, that signal molecule has to bind to a receptor that has just the right shape to receive that signal molecule. That's why I was talking about the analogy between a key and a lock. It fits just right. And this is why we can broadcast hormones all through the blood to all the body, but only certain tissues will respond, because if a cell does not have the right receptor for a signal, it won't even know the signal molecule is there. Nothing will happen. Well, these are drugs, exogenous signals, but they still operate by binding to receptors. And they're chiral drugs, meaning there's a left-handed and a right-handed version, but only one of those two versions has any effect. And that's because the receptor itself is either right-handed or left-handed. You know, if you imagine, not surgical gloves, that's a bad example, but real thick gloves, like a baseball glove, for instance. You can't put the other hand in a baseball glove that's designed for the left hand. You can't put your right hand in it, right? And use it properly. Similarly, if you have a right-handed receptor, only the right-handed signal will work. The left-handed signal, even though it's almost identical, it's just the mirror image, will not fit into that receptor. So there's an effective version and an ineffective version of each of these drugs. But notice that it's on a drug-by-drug basis, and really on a receptor-by-receptor basis, as to which version is the effective one. You can't say it's always right that's good or always left that's good. In the case of ibuprofen, it is the left-handed version that works. The right-handed version does nothing. Just the opposite for albuterol. Well, 9 is really the same thing. This is another mirror image or chiral compound. They are enantiomers of each other, except that this is not exogenous, this is endogenous. Well, in the case of L-DOPA, it is. L and D designation are left and right, as I said. L-DOPA is made in your body. Well, D-DOPA is possible to make that as a drug, but it won't have any effect because the receptors are left-handed. So it has to be specific. Brings us to 10. These are two molecules that look very similar structurally, and they are almost identical. But they have drastically different effects in the body. These are two steroid hormones. Not the only two. There's many steroid hormones that we make in the body. And they're all very similar for good reason. They all start out as exactly the same stuff, which is cholesterol, which animals cannot live without. That's one reason we can't live without cholesterol. There's other reasons as well. So it all starts out as cholesterol, which then gets slightly modified one way or another to become different molecules that have drastically different effects. Estradiol is the major estrogen. Estrogens have much different effects compared to testosterone. Estrogens are feminizing hormones, right? Testosterone is a masculizing hormone. But despite having those hugely different effects on the body, they're very, very similar. And they share this batch of rings, which is the gold-colored part, because that's the same as cholesterol that they started with. What's different about them is highlighted in blue, which is just a couple atoms here and there hanging off of the bulk of the molecule. And those things that are highlighted in blue here are examples of functional groups, which you were kind of introduced to in the lab. But now we're going to talk more about functional groups. So functional groups are not entire molecules. They're not if you made a ball and stick model of a functional group, it would not be complete, right? There would be unresolved bonds. So it's only part of a molecule. It's hanging off of the rest of the molecule. And it's not all that big. It's just a small collection of atoms. But we call them functional groups because they give that overall molecule, whatever it is, certain functions or certain chemical properties because of that particular arrangement of atoms that makes up the functional group. Let's look at the ones that are important for this course. Slide 11 and slide 12 make up one table. In the book, it would have been one table. And I want you to realize that everything I say in this room, of course, is always fair game for a lecture exam, like the one that's coming up. But 11 and 12, slides 11 and 12, this table of functional groups, in other words, that's also fair game for the upcoming quiz, lab quiz, because this is stuff that you were supposed to have paid attention to when you're building your model. So it's not the only thing. You still have the recording from that I made from that day, but this is also fair game for that quiz. Every one of these columns in the table is a different functional group, and notice that every one of them is represented two ways, by a ball and stick model and by a functional group, by a structural formula. And it doesn't matter which one you look at, either one has at least one bond that isn't being satisfied, right? Which is just another way of saying these are not molecules by themselves. They're not complete molecules. They're just part of a bigger molecule. And depending on the book, you'll have things like this, just a bond hanging off that is not connected to anything. Some books, and I think your manual does this, will list it as R and then the function group, R-OH, for instance, for this first one. The R stands for residue, which simply means what's left over, meaning the rest of the molecule, whatever it is. It can be anything. But the first one, the first group, is a hydroxyl, which is an OH group. Notice, by the way, that you could write this as R-OH, or you could write it as HO-R. That's the same thing, right? But you can't write it as R-HO. What's wrong with that? But why can't it be? Why isn't this going to happen? What are you saying?
It can't, because it needs to be bonding. The rest of it needs to be bonding to the oxygen and not the hydrogen.
Well, yes, that's what a hydroxyl is, but I'm saying this isn't even going to happen. It's not even going to be possible. Why? Yeah.
I forgot that the name of it, but because the hydrogen only has one thing.
Yes. What is she forgetting?
The
valence. Hydrogen has a valence of one, so it can only make one bond. That's one problem. It's making two bonds here, right? One with the rest of the molecule, one with oxygen. Also, oxygen has a valence of two. It has to make two bonds. It's only making one here. So that is not the same thing, and it's not going to happen. Okay, but let's talk about the hydroxyl group. A lot of organic compounds have hydroxyl in it. In fact, you notice that with glucose. Glucose has hydroxyls in it, right? That you built. Anything that has at least one hydroxyl, and it can have multiple hydroxyls, but any compound that has a hydroxyl group is a member of a category that we call alcohols. That's what makes something an alcohol, that it has a hydroxyl. And there's all kinds of alcohol. In fact, the glucose that you built is an alcohol because it has hydroxyls. We're used to thinking of one alcohol when we just say the word in everyday life, which is the alcohol that's in any alcoholic beverage, whether it's beer, wine, or spirits, it's always the same alcohol. It's the only one that you should drink. Well, I shouldn't say that, because you can drink sugar water, which is an alcohol. But anyway, there are other alcohols that you definitely shouldn't drink, is the thing. Notice, by the way, that the specific name of any given alcohol usually ends in OL to tell you it's an alcohol, like ethanol. It can also be called ethyl alcohol, but ethanol is just one word that means the same thing. And notice that if instead of that hydroxyl, it were just another H, that would be ethane, right? The two-carbon hydrocarbon. That's why it's called ethanol. It's ethane-like alcohol. Now, alcohols are important in biology because, for various reasons, but just in general, they're important because the hydroxyl group, which is OH, is polar, just like the OH in water. The OH bond in water is polar, right? Because oxygen has a much higher electronegativity than hydrogen. So where you have the hydroxyl in the molecule makes that part of it polar. Next up is the carbonyl group. And this one's a little bit different because, well, for two reasons. One is that one of the atoms in the carbonyl group, unlike the hydroxyl, is carbon. So the carbonyl group has an atom in it that is actually part of the carbon skeleton, right? Remember, there's a carbon skeleton in any given organic compound. Well, the hydroxyl is not part of the carbon skeleton. It's attached to the carbon skeleton. A carbonyl, on the other hand, the carbon part of the carbonyl is part of the actual carbon skeleton. But the other reason it's a little different is that notice that there are two unsatisfied bonds here. Carbon is tetravalent, so it makes sense that it makes sense that it's making four overall bonds. Two of those, though, are used as a double bond with oxygen, which is why you use springs to represent them in the ball and stick model. That leaves two other bonds unsatisfied. So that means that there's really two major possibilities if you have a carbonyl group in an organic compound. If you consider the overall carbon skeleton, however big it is, there are tips, some number of tips on a carbon skeleton, right? If it's a linear arrangement, there are just two tips, right? If there's one branch, there's three tips. If there's more and more branches, there's a lot of tips. But you understand the difference between a tip of a skeleton and somewhere deeper into the skeleton. Those are the two possibilities for the placement of the carbon in a carbonyl with respect to the carbon skeleton. And so instead of just calling anything with a carbonyl one category, like we did with hydroxyls, they're all alcohols, there are two separate categories of carbonyl-containing compounds, which are called ketones and aldehydes. So ketone is not a specific chemical, aldehyde's not a specific chemical, each one of them is a category. And the difference, meaning what makes something either a ketone or an aldehyde, because it's one or the other, not both, is whether that carbon that's part of the carbonyl is at a tip of the carbon skeleton or not. You can see one example of each here. Notice that in this one, which is acetone, the carbon is not at a tip. And in the other one, which is propanol, it is at a tip. Okay, well, the ones that have the chemicals, carbonyl-containing chemicals that have the carbon at a tip are called aldehydes. And the ones that are not at the tip are called ketones. And I used to confuse these, couldn't remember which was which, and it occurred to me one day that the word aldehyde starts with A, which is at a tip of the alphabet. Ketone, on the other hand, is a K somewhere in the middle of the alphabet. So that's how I keep track of them. But notice acetone, that's a specific chemical, ends in O-N-E to tell you it's a ketone. And propanol, not propanol, which is an alcohol, propanol ends in A-L to tell you it's an aldehyde. Next is the carboxyl group. And when you look at the ball and stick model, or more easily, the structural formula model, it looks like it's simply a combination of a carbonyl and a hydroxyl, the two that we just went over, right? And it is, really. And that's exactly why it's called carboxyl. The name itself is a combination of carbonyl and hydroxyl. It's a portmanteau, a word that's a combination of two other words. But anyway, we don't really consider it to be either a carbonyl or a hydroxyl. When the two are combined in this exact arrangement, we consider that to be its own distinct group, carboxyl. So if you're counting functional groups, for instance, you wouldn't count this as a carbonyl or a hydroxyl, it would be one carboxyl. And these are, it's impossible to overstate the importance of these to biology. Well, first let me tell you that the category of compounds that contain a carboxyl group is carboxylic acids. So anything with a carboxyl group is a carboxylic acid. Another word that it means exactly the same thing, interchangeable word for that, is organic acid. Now you already know that organic means carbon containing, right? Well, really, most of the familiar acids, like hydrochloric acid or sulfuric acid, don't have any carbon in them. So they're inorganic acids. The carboxyl group makes it acidic. But since it has carbon in it, they used to be called organic acids quite often. The more modern term, though, is carboxylic acid. And it makes it, I think it's a better word because it tells you specifically it has a carboxyl in it. Anyway, back to how these are indispensably important to biology. Proteins, I keep telling you, are indispensable to organisms because they do just about all the important jobs in any given cell. And proteins, as we'll talk more about in the next chapter, are big molecules made out of subunits that are hooked together, and those subunits are amino acids. There are different kinds of amino acids, but every amino acid, by definition, that we'll get into later, contains a carboxyl group. So in other words, every protein that's ever existed is made up of some number of subunits, each of which contains a carboxyl group. Can't have proteins without them, and therefore you can't have living things without them. Continues the same table. Next one up is the amino group. Now, whenever you see amino or amine or ammo, any words like that, or roots like that, you know that it's specifying nitrogen. There must be nitrogen involved somehow. And you can see that the amino group features a nitrogen bonded singly to each of two hydrogens, and then the third bond for nitrogen is with the residue. Okay, that's an amino group, and anything that has that, we classify as amines. Well, this one is equally as indispensable as carboxylic acids, and for exactly the same reason. I said that those subunits of proteins are called amino acids. Well, amino acids, in addition to containing a carboxyl group, contain an amino group. Glycine is shown here as an example. That's the simplest possible amino acid. There are other amino acids, but every amino acid is going to have an amino group on one side, and notice what we have here, a carboxyl group on the other side. And this is exactly why they're called amino acids. Amino from amino, of course, and acid from the fact that they're carboxylic acids because they have a carboxyl group in them. So you can't have any proteins without either of these functional groups, amines, I mean, amino or carboxyl. Sulfhydryl is next. And which of the ones that we've already looked at is this most similar to? Yeah, it's very similar to hydroxyl, right? The difference, of course, is that instead of an oxygen, you have a sulfur. So it's SH instead of OH. Why, by the way, does that make sense? Why does it make sense for S to take the place of O?
They have the same valence.
Yeah, they have the same valence. They're in the same group, right? Which is exactly why you used an oxygen ball to represent a sulfur ball in one of your molecules. Or you should have if you did all the modeling. Okay, so sulfhydryl is very similar and has similar properties, but it's distinct. Now, I already told you that things that have a hydroxyl are called alcohols. Things that contain a sulfhydryl are called thiols, which implies that they're alcohols. A thiol is not truly an alcohol because it doesn't have an OH. But the thio part of that is a root that means sulfur. And therefore, thiol literally means sulfur alcohol. It's not a real alcohol, but it's like it. And the example that they give you here is yet another amino acid. It's not the point of this example, but notice this has a carboxyl and an amino group. So it's an amino acid. Anyway, this side, though, has the sulfhydryl. And the amino acid is called cysteine, as you see, just one of many amino acids. But if you have a protein which is kind of like a string of beads, and several of those beads, any position, are cysteine with these sulfhydryls. When you fold it up, which brings beads that aren't next to each other on the string close to each other, the sulfhydryls can interact, get rid of the hydrogens, and the two sulfur atoms can covalently bond, which locks the shape of the protein into place, makes it very stable. And your hairs have a lot of cysteine amino acids in them, which is why burning hair, that smell of burning hair, is a sulfur smell. Okay, now to phosphate. Of the ones we need to know for this course, the phosphate is the most complex in terms of the number of atoms involved. As you can see, it's a phosphorus atom. That's the essence of the name, of course. Phosphorus atom, P, surrounded by four oxygen atoms. One of those oxygen atoms is bonded to the residue. And also notice that two of the oxygens are ionized, which is important for reasons I'll talk about in a second. But it's one of the oxygens that actually makes the connection with the rest of the molecule, not the phosphorus atom. Phosphorus is part of it, though, as you see. And, you know, I've already told you indispensable reasons why we need all these functional groups. Phosphate is indispensable for multiple reasons. No organism would exist for several reasons without phosphate. One of which is that phosphate is part of an important essential molecule called a phospholipid. And we'll be getting into why that's important in the next chapter. But every cell that's ever existed has by definition of being a cell, it has a plasma membrane, which is the boundary between the cell and everything else. Well, every plasma membrane, regardless of which domain you're in, no matter what organism you are, that plasma membrane is made up of a collection of phospholipids. And this actually goes back to what we were talking about in the beginning of this slide, the experiment that was concerned with setting the stage for the first cells to exist. Well, you have to have phospholipids on hand. They were had to build up on Earth in the oceans before there could be the first cells. Because if you have phospholipids, just regular phospholipid molecules, no life, and you put them into water, they will automatically form a bilayer that looks just like a cell. It forms a little sac. And so that's how the first cells came into existence. But every cell since then features phospholipids. Another reason, though, equally important, is that phosphate is used in ATP molecules and related molecules that store energy short-term, regardless of species. All of you have heard of ATP, I would say, but we'll be studying it in much greater detail in Unit 3, but the short version is that we don't use energy from our food directly to power the things that require energy in our cells. Instead, we extract the energy from the food molecules, put that energy into the form of ATP temporarily, and then we get it back out of ATP in order to power the things that require energy. That wouldn't be possible without phosphate. And then still a third really important thing is that phosphates can serve as little molecular switches, in a sense. Another thing we'll be talking much more about are enzymes, which are proteins that act as catalysts to speed up reactions. And so your metabolism, which is your life, would not happen if those reactions that make up metabolism weren't helped by enzymes. But you don't always want to be running every reaction that you're capable of, right? You only want to run the reactions when it's appropriate, which means it would be nice to be able to control enzymes so that they're not continuously working. You can switch them on or off as needed. Phosphate can do that. Not just with enzymes, other proteins as well. If you hook a phosphate on to something else, it's called phosphorylation. If you take it back off, it's called dephosphorylation. And that's an easy way to either activate or deactivate a protein like an enzyme. Instead of destroying it when you don't need it, and then the next moment if you need it again, you have to having to build it fresh again. It takes a lot more time and it takes energy. Methyl is the final one for this course. And you see a lot of these in chemicals, because any of these tips of the skeleton I'm talking about, however many tips there are in the carbon skeleton, a lot of them are occupied by methyl, because the carbon itself is at one of the tips, right? It's forming a bond with another carbon to be part of the skeleton, so that's one of its four bonds. The easiest way to satisfy the other three bonds for that tip carbon is to just fill it with three hydrogens. So you find, typically in a complex molecule, many different methyls within the same molecule. But methyl, as a functional group, can also be used as a little molecular switch, much like phosphate. Only instead of proteins typically being methylated or unmethylated, DNA is. If you think about the cells that make up your body, if you ignore the mutations that have occurred in some of those cells, which, you know, as older you get, more and more damage to DNA has occurred, but most of it is still pretty similar to the DNA you got when you started. Anyway, every cell has a full library, right? Every cell of your body that has DNA has every gene therefore instructions for how to build any kind of protein. Well, you wouldn't want any cell of your body to use all of those genes. It's only appropriate to use some of them. You don't want the kidney to be making fingernails. But it has the ability to, because it has those genes, right? So in any given cell, certain genes need to be more or less permanently turned off so you don't accidentally read them. And you can do that by adding methyl groups to that section of DNA that we call those genes. Okay, so that's the functional groups. That leaves us with only one slide left in the unit, slide 13, which is really just a picture of ATP that I was talking about earlier. ATP is an acronym for adenosine triphosphate. We'll worry in a different chapter about what makes this adenosine, but adenosine could by itself be a molecule. If you then add some number of phosphates, it becomes a more complex. And if you add three phosphates, daisy chained together like this, it's adenosine triphosphate. And that's how cells in general, not just our cells, store the energy that's extracted from the nutrients. And it's very short-term storage, because the next moment you might be spending that energy for something which involves dismantling this. First you add phosphates to store the energy, and then you remove them to get the energy back out. That's exactly what's happening here. So notice that the ATP molecule is being dephosphorylated of one of its phosphates. So you end up with adenosine diphosphate. That releases some energy, and the phosphate that you've cleaved off is now just by itself. Now, careful with this P notation, because a P by itself means a phosphorus atom. That's not what we have here. This is a phosphate group. So a P with a circle has the phosphorus atom, but there are four oxygen atoms there as well, remember. Well, these P's that are still stuck to the adenosine are part of an organic molecule, because there's carbon in adenosine. When you cleave one off, though, there's no C in the phosphate group itself, right? It's just P and four O's. So when it's on its own, we call it inorganic phosphate, because it's no longer part of an organic molecule. No carbon in it. And that's what the little I subscript means. It means a phosphate by itself, inorganic phosphate. So that is the chapter and the unit. Now, before I stop recording, anyone have any questions about anything coming up on this test? I already told you to get Scantron forms, right? Okay, good. Yeah?
So the exam will contain everything in that chapter that we just learned?
It can, yes. Everything up until where I just stopped now is fair game for the test, as long as I have told you it. I will never have a question about something that I never mention in my recordings. Yeah.
How many questions?
50 exactly on all five tests. And each question is A, B, C, or D, so there's four choices of each as well. Yeah.
On some of the recordings, when you mention stuff in later chapters, none of that would be included, or could it surface it?
Well, only the aspect that I actually talk about currently could be. But when I say we'll get deeper into it, that deeper part, no, that won't be until a later test. And by the way, the more I talk about something, because I repeat things sometimes from chapter to chapter, the more I stress things, the more likely it is it's going to be part of a question. You know, I can't have a question about everything I say, but it is all fair game. Yeah.
I've also seen there's probably multiple choice and there's fill in the blanks too.
No, they're all multiple choice. Yes. Unless you don't show up for an exam. If you don't show up for an exam, you don't get a permanent zero, you get a temporary zero. But the makeup version is no multiple choice, it's all short answer. Yeah.
Okay.
So we're taking it on a Tuesday. Are we still going to have a lab right after?
Yes, you still have a lab right after, which means that you have to... You can't forget the functional groups when you walk out the door after the test, because you still need to know those for the quiz as well. In fact, don't forget this stuff ever after you do the test. The whole idea is not to take tests, it's to learn the stuff. But there will be a gap, depending on how long you take for the test. All we do on test days is the test in here. So if you get out of here in 20 minutes, which is when people are usually done first, then you'll have that extra time before lab. We still have lab as scheduled, though.
Do you have any pictures?
No. Any other questions?
Should we be scared?
Well, I don't want you to be scared. I want you to believe everything I've said about the difficulty of the course in general and the tests compared to other kinds of points. And I mean, unless you guys are truly different from everyone else I've ever taught, which I doubt, you know, every class is more or less the same, I can pretty much guarantee you that the average grade is going to be about a 66, somewhere around there, 66%. And it's going to go down from there. The second one's going to be significantly lower.
Why?
Well, just because that's what happens. I know it because I've taught it that many times.
But why do you think that even if like, you're giving us all the tools and we have the recorded lectures, if like, you're going to go back, is it just because you think that people aren't studying or just aren't retaining?
No, I don't think they're not studying. I think they're not studying enough. And that's not necessarily anyone's fault. The big problem nowadays is that people are doing way too many things in their life.
Mm-hmm.
So if you have a spouse or a child or a job, those things interfere. And I understand that you have to do those things too. But I can't say, well, this person has a job and a spouse and a kid, therefore I'll pass this person because that's an excuse. It's not an excuse. In the old days, back in my day, that was when, you know, you graduated from high school and you didn't work, you weren't married, you didn't have children. It was your job to be a student. That was your full-time job. We're out of those days. But we still have to grade you as though it were those days. Anything else? I mean, should I stop recording? Because it gets hard to listen to if there's no more questions. Okay.